Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Poke Runyon. And tonight we present a serious and a lighthearted look at Halloween. Every Halloween we hold the Dark Mother of all Halloween parties on the nearest Saturday to the 31st. And we have a serious ritual in the outdoor henge invoking Moat, the Lord of Death, who asks each one around the circle, "What say you to honor the dead?" Followed by a jovial Halloween costume party, which features a comedy skit. Now, this year, we did an impromptu radio play, Sherlock Holmes and the Necronomicon. And this was based on an article in the Seventh Ray, number 3, The Green Ray, which you can get on Amazon. And we will read the ritual out in the henge, and then we'll play part of the radio drama skit, or all of it if it goes fairly well. Now, this is our Halloween party on the air, so tune in, answer Moat's somber question, and then join in on the fun. Now, first off on this somber note, we'll read through the what Frederick Osiris is calling the Moat Mass. This is our witchcraft friends would call a Samhain celebration. And as you probably know from Canaanite mythology, Moat is the original Grim Reaper. He's Baal's brother. He is the god of death. He lives in caverns in the back of beyond, and he has all the aspects of a god of the underworld. So we have out in the henge, we have two standing torches to provide illumination. Moat sits in the pavilion, very quietly in the pavilion. The Lord of the Vines, that's our high priest, he gathers the celebrants in the staging area, which in Rivendell's across the bridge. And the Odos reads the prologue. In ancient times, people venerated their ancestors from the recently deceased to as far back as they could trace their family lineage. They made offerings to their ancestral spirits and had feasts and celebrations in their honor. In the ancient Canaanite tradition, Moat, the Lord of Death, is the ruler of the underworld and the keeper of the departed souls. On this particular night, tradition holds that the gates between the worlds are open and the spirits of the departed are hovering near. So join with us as we descend down the winding path to the back of beyond, where we will invoke the Lord of Darkness himself, drink the wine of remembrance from the cup of souls, and honor those who have passed the veil. And this is the Widdershins circle chant. Down and down the path we go, to the caverns far below, past the seven gates of dread, to the kingdom of the dead. Hoy-a-hee, hoy-a-don, hoy-a-hee, hoy-a-don. Go to the vines and the odos, then enter the henge, while the celebrants are circled around it. The odos sings or recites the Orphic hymn to death. Hear me, O death, whose empire unconfined extends to normal tribes of every kind. On thee a portion of our time depends, whose absence lengthens life, whose presence ends. Thy sleep perpetual bursts the vivid folds by which the soul attracting body holds, common to all of every sex and age, for naught escapes thy whole destructive range. Not youth itself thy clemency can gain, vigorous and strong by thee untimely slain. In thee the end of nature's works is known, in thee all judgment is absolved alone. And then the Lord of the Vines invokes Moat. Great Lord of darkness, death, and gloom, and the deepest secrets of the tomb, we circle round the wheel of fate to honor souls who pass your gate. Now help us to remember and revere the souls of those we yet hold dear. The somber drumbeat, Moat, enters carrying the cup of souls, which of course is shaped like a human skull. Moat processes Widdershins around the inside of the circle to a slow, muffled drumbeat while the Odos reads from the scroll. And this is Lord Byron's ode to a drinking cup made from a skull. Start not, or deem my spirit fled. In me, behold, the only skull from which, unlike a living head, whatever flows is never dull. I lived, I loved, I quaffed like thee. I died. Let earth my bones resign. Fill up, thou canst not injure me. The worm hath fouler lips than thine. Better to hold the sparkling grape than nurse the earthworm's slimy brood and circle in the goblet shape. The drink of gods than reptile's food. Where once my wit perchance hath shone, in aid of others, let me shine. And when at last our brains are gone, what nobler substitute than wine? Quaff while thou canst another race. When thou and thine, like me, are sped, may rescue thee from earth's embrace and rhyme and revel with the dead. Why not? Since through life's little day, our heads such sad effects produce. Redeemed from worms and wasting clay, this chance is theirs to be of use. And drink ye also in memory of Lord Byron, who penned these immortal lines. Moat comes to the table, holds up the flagon, saying, the wine of remembrance. He holds up the cup, declaring the cup of souls. Moat fills the cup and makes eye contact with the celebrants, saying, who drinks with me? And they reply, we drink with thee. And the somber drumbeat commences, and Moat circles the inside the circle Widdershins, The entrance chant is repeated. Down and down the path we go to the caverns far below, past the seven gates of dread to the kingdom of the dead. The drum beat stops. Moose selects a celebrant and commands, drink. The celebrant drinks and hands back the cup, and Moose says, what say you to honor the dead? And the celebrant then honors his ancestors. Moat takes up the dance and the chant again. The drumbeat resumes, and the sequence is repeated until all have been served. And then the drumbeat stops. Moat elevates the cup and then pours the dregs on the ground. He takes up the flagon and empties it into the earth, saying, a libation to those remembered this night. And as you return to the realm of light, pray to be honored by those you knew when this cup is passed for you. Lord of the Vines leads the celebrants Deosil, chanting, up and up the path we go, from the caverns down below. We've paid homage to the dead. Feast and revel lie ahead. Oy-a-e, oy-a-don, oy-a-e, oy-a-don. So that concludes our serious and appropriate, by the way, Halloween ceremony. And then we went back into the hermitage. We had about 35 members and guests. Went back into the hermitage, and we had our little potluck feast and socialized a bit. And then when we got to the point where we wouldn't ordinarily have a bardic circle, we did our skit. Now, this is a tradition. Every year we have a comedy skit. The year before, we had Dr. X and I created a homunculus, and that was rather humorous. We had to cut the homunculus. We had King Solomon cut the homunculus in half with an electric power saw. This is a tradition with us. We always have this comedy skit at the Halloween party. Well, this time, I decided to try something experimental. And I thought we would create an impromptu old-time radio drama. And so I wrote a script for this in radio drama style. And there was no rehearsal on this, nobody knew what parts they were going to get. We assigned parts. There were six of us, and we assigned the parts just kind of random. As one of our members suggested, we better do it down in the temple because, you can't do any kind of a radio show in a room full of people having a party. So we took the six of us who were going to do this, and we went down to the temple, which is downstairs, and we got into the temple. And so what I did was I just read through the script once. We already assigned parts. I just read through the script once, and then I handed everybody a copy of it. And I turned on the recorder, and we did it. Now, we had a synthesizer, and we had a very, very talented musician. I mean, this world-class musician, and that's Frater Orpheus, and he's well-named. Frater Orpheus on the synthesizer, and he was just, he had was just instructions, sinister music, and he had to improvise all of this. And I got to a certain point where we had a hole of the Mountain King, and he didn't know that one, and so turned around to Frater Nemanides, who played Sherlock Holmes, and between the two of them, they improvised Hall of the Mountain King in the middle of this. Now, this really is impromptu, and we haven't even edited this. I mean, I haven't even tightened up the dead air in between. What we're going to do is I'm going to run this right off the recorder, and if you can get it, if you can hear it, if you're getting it, then that's great. Considering that it's certainly not ready for prime time or anything like that. But if you can't, those of you in the chat room, if it's really not coming through at all, then let us know and we will stop and we'll then I'll just read the rest of it from the script. so you won't miss anything. But we'll give this a try and see. So let us know how it's come across, okay? So let me get set up here, and we'll give it a whack here. All right. All right, I'm recording. Good evening, and welcome to Magical Mystery Theater of the Air. Tonight, we present one of the most bizarre cases from the files of that famous Victorian-age detective Sherlock Holmes, an adventure we call Sherlock Holmes and the Necronomicon. Come with us now to Scotland in the year 1898. It is almost midnight in the great hall of an ancient castle on the shore of Loch Ness. And the only illumination is a candelabra set on a table. A seance is in progress. The medium is Lady Livonia Dithers. Sitting next to Livonia is her husband, the laird of the castle, MacGregor Dithers. And to his right sits the sinister magician, Sebastian Crouchley. Or Crouchley. Livonia Dithers is in deep trance as the clock strikes 12.
It's midnight, Livonia, my dear. Are you in contact with Lord Angus MacGregor?
Yes, MacGregor. The spirit of your ancestor is upon me. Heavens, are you hurt, MacGregor?
Oh, no, my dear. It's all part of the drill. Is it not, Brother Crossley?
It's Crossley, Dermot.
Here, let me help you up, Mr. Crossley.
Now, that's good. Now, what's there to me the secret formula? G, 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 hyphen, G, 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 G.
Great green, gooey gobs of grimy, granulated gorilla grunt.
Oh, Mr. Crossley, such language.
You haven't heard anything yet, my dear.
Now, let's be off to the crypt, Brother Crossley.
When McGregor leading the way, carrying a torch, they descend a steep, narrow flight of stone steps, leading down to the Stygian depths of the dungeons and crypts beneath the ancient castle, coming at last to an iron-bound door which creaks open. And they enter the sealed crypt. The torch illuminates a stone pillar standing in the exact center of the floor, and upon its pedestal rests a large book, bound in tortured skin, torn from what was once a human face, the dreaded Necronomicon. Well, send the funeral fairies.
You can't see them. They're invisible. Now, there's the book, Brother Crossley. You go get it. I'll guard the door.
Oh, there we are. Over here, at the book. So far, so good. I'll just pick it up and...
Oh.
Get off the other side. Hey, come back here, Crossley. They'll eat you alive. Oh, let me catch my breath. Oh, those little creatures are fiendish. They wouldn't even let me touch the book.
Because you're not really a Palladian, are you?
Well, I gave you the recognition sign and the fake formula, didn't I?
It's not great green gooey gobs. It's great green greasy gobs. You're an imposter, Mr. Crossley. I'll thank you to leave my house and don't come back.
Well, I'll have you know that I've been thrown out of much better places. Good evening, Mr. McGregor.
And you can be sure I will be back.
McGregor closes the door with a crypt.
And conducts Sebastian Crossley, or Crossley, up the stairs. But meanwhile, back inside the chamber, water begins rising up from the stone floor. Flooding the room, almost to the top of the pillar, the dark water swirls and splashes. As a strange, glistening shape moves up behind the Necronomicon. While upstairs, McGregor has just shown Sebastian Crossley out, when suddenly
an invisible pincher clamps on his nose, dragging him back toward the cellar.
What's the matter, Mr. Gregor, dear? Your nose, it's bleeding.
Hey, one of the fairies has caught me. He's dragging me back down there.
Whatever for?
How the hell would I know?
Lavonia follows her husband down the steps to the door of the crypt, which is now standing open. The door is receding, draining out into the lake. The water is receding, but the Necronomicon is no longer on the pedestal. The next morning, outside the castle, a bearded postman rides up to the McGregor mailbox and picks up the outgoing mail. He takes a letter addressed to Professor Higginbottom and puts it in his pocket, while the other letters go into his mailbag. And then, whistling the Hall of the Mountain King, he pedals off down the road. On the following day, at 221 Baker Street in London, Dr. John Watson is brewing tea, while Sherlock Holmes sits in his easy chair smoking his calabash. And a series of knocks on the door are heard.
Great, green, greasy gobs of grimy granulated.
Disgusting.
To the pure, all things are pure, my dear Watson. Our visitor is a Palladian. Would you be so kind as to let him in?
Good afternoon. Yes, quite. Won't you come in?
Ah, Professor Higginbottom. I read your treatise on the Great Pyramid. Brilliant! But I hardly recognize you with a beard.
Well, I gave a share of body nuisance.
May I ask why an archaeologist needs the services of a consulting detective?
I am Balk?
The Queen of Sheba. Why have you called me?
The Necronomicon has disappeared. Can you tell us who took it? Do you know where it is?
The great old one of the watery deep has taken it. It is now in his keeping. No one summons Cthulhu. He summons you. Beware. Beware.
She's fading. She's fading. She's gone.
Who gets the bottom of this?
Yes, Higginbotham. We certainly will. McGregor, you have those items I suggested.
They are right here, Mr. Holmes.
Watson, you have that pair of the bait fish?
Right here, Holmes.
Good. Then lead us down to the crypt, McGregor.
Having descended to the crypt, they find the chamber door open and the floor still damp.
What about the cannibal fairies?
Have you brought the haggis?
Aye, can you not smell it?
Holmes, they won't eat that.
Of course they will, Watson. They're Scottish fairies.
You're right, Holmes. We'll devour you.
Now, in we go.
Just as I thought. Do you see what appears to be the puddle of water over there by the far wall? By the lakeside?
Or below the level of the lake, Mr. Holmes? We always had seepage down here.
It's more than seepage, McGregor. Watson, throw the fish into the pool.
My God!
Out of the dark pool rises the giant head and the long, glistening neck of a prehistoric monster of the deep, a plesiosaurus of the Jurassic, an aquatic dinosaur.
Quick, Watson, quick. Throw another fish.
The great beast snatches the fish in midair, swallows it in one gulp, and then descends back down into the pool, disappearing from view.
There's your prophet, Professor Higginbotham.
Oh, yes, yes, Cthulhu.
She never said it was. Cthulhu is something Sebastian Crotchley would have ever said.
Yes. Crouchley!
And so it is. Now, let us take the fake beard off, shall we?
Oh, curses, foiled again. How did you know it was me?
I knew you weren't Higginbotham. He fell off the Great Pyramid in 96 and broke both legs, his hips and his tailbone. He could never have given the Palladian recognition stone. And of course, I did question McGregor at some length before we arrived.
Holmes, I never knew you were Palladian.
Did I was?
How did you ever determine the real thief's identity?
The thought of the crypt has come from the lake. So it's the elemental, my dear Watson. A particularly large element indeed, as a matter of fact. Plesiosaurus nisi, if we must be scientific.
I'll pour the bucket of baked fish down the drain here and see if we can bring him up again.
No, he'll be back, McGregor. But feed him only one fish at a time. If you want to get the Necronomicon back. And even if he can't find it for you, once you have trained him, he'll make an excellent tourist attraction.
Oh, how fancy. It's for colorful fellas.
They've eaten the haggis. We're never getting out of here.
Where's Quaxley?
There he is, in the crypt, reaching down into that pool. Look, he's found a Necronomicon.
They're eating him alive. Oh, devil.
Oh, poor Mr. Crossley.
It's Crossley. The same thing happened to Abdul Al-Hazir when he completed the Necronomicon over 1,000 years ago. It's a bit of a fitting conclusion, I should think.
And so ends our story of Sherlock Holmes and the Necronomicon. This is the Magical Mystery Theater of the Air, bidding you a happy Halloween and pleasant dreams. Good night. Sleep tight. And don't let the cannibal fairies bite. Our cast included Prater Leviathan as McGregor, Sarar Sari as Lavonia, Crouchley was played by Frater Thavion, and who also played Professor Higginbottom, and the Queen of Sheba was Sarar Urania. The Watson was played by Frater K.M., and Sherlock Holmes was Frater Memnonides, and the Loch Ness Monster was, I'm not going to reveal the identity of the Loch Ness Monster until you give me another fish. And so, it was a lot of fun, and we should have edited it, cut out some of the dead air and whatever, but this was very impromptu, and to tell you quite frankly, we sat in a semicircle. We didn't move the altar out of the center of the temple. Now we should have sat in a circle equidistant from an omni stereo microphone, but we didn't do that, and we should have kept the scripts loose so we could drop the pages, but instead of that, that would have caused confusion, so we stapled them so there was a lot of paper rustling, what have you. So we promised to do better next time, but then on the other hand, we thought the spontaneity of it, and if you do it just exactly the way we recorded it, you might enjoy it that way. So let us know how you liked it, and if you'd like us to do more of this sort of thing, because, you know, this is a lot of fun, and I think we have some rather talented, you know, people. But and I'd like to encourage the rest of you to do this sort of thing. This is a great thing to do at a party, at a theme party especially. And the story that it comes from is an adapted version of an article in the Seventh Ray. That's the Green Ray. That's our latest Seventh Ray. That's called Book 3, The Green Ray. And I'll plug again, and so you can get it on Amazon. And they have it in stock. I think it's shipping right away. In time for the holidays and all that. But the story is, the article is called Sherlock Holmes and the Curse of the Necronomicon. And the story actually, what it was an outline, detailed outline for, or treatment for a two-act play. And in that two-act play, we had more characters, and we had a Gilbert and Sullivan premiere that they were, and in that premiere, we presented our patter song, There Ain't No Necronomicon, which I believe you've all heard. Sirs Andre, have you got a green ray up there? I've got time, I can read that, because that was part of this originally. Oh, thank you. And that, by the way, was an internet classic. There Ain't No Necronomicon. So we had in the original Sherlock Holmes story, we had Gilbert and Sullivan had this play they'd done called the Wacky Wizards of Whippersnatch. Now, actually, Gilbert and Sullivan really did do an operetta called The Sorcerer. And they had a wonderful patter song in there called My Name is John Wellington Wells. I'm a dealer in magic and spells, which, by the way, we'll do sometime on the show. But this one, McGregor captured the cannibal fairies with a butterfly net and put them in a carpet bag and took them to London and released them during the Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. And you can imagine the cannibal kind of panic the cannibal fairies would cause during this operetta, and the Queen Victoria, was in her royal box, and she had Prince Albert, her consort, in there with her, and Albert was scratching and dancing around, and Queen Victoria looked at him and said, "Albert, we are not amused." You know, well, anyway, but the centerpiece of that one was There Ain't No Necronomicon, and this was copyright 1992 by Eric Hoffman and Poke Runyon, and it's to the tune of a very modern major general, but I don't know whether I can do that. Anyway, it goes this way. Every few years you will see an ad as well lit as can be, offering for sale a book whose title is The Selling Book. It's called The Necronomicon, to summon horrors from beyond, or so was claimed by HPO, ripped by an Arab mad as hell. The author, poor Abdul al-Hazred, was et by demons in Damascus, and how his book survived, don't ask us. Lovecraft's fans, both far and near, have searched for many a fruitless year to find this book of evil spells, but the truth is sad to tell. There ain't no Necronomicon, there is a Key of Solomon, a Lesser Key of the Megaton, there's a Grimoire of Honorius, and other books notorious, Heptameron and Chiridon, complete with Tetragrammaton, but there ain't no Necronomicon, of that we have no doubt. There is a grand grimoire, true grimoire, and Solomon's Ars Notoria. There's Armadale and Arbitel, and other catalogs of hell. There's Picatrix, not Pickup Sticks, and other books of dirty tricks. There's manuscripts by Faustion and tablets of Enochian, but there ain't no Necronomicon, and that's a natural fact. Now, we ran that way, way back on the internet, back in the, 92, 93.
And, of course, the Necronomicon crowd, the people that want to think that there was a Necronomicon, they didn't like it very much, but it was an internet crowd. You can find it. If you Google it, there ain't no Necronomicon. You Google that, and it'll come up all over the place. But since then, I think, you know, we did correct this when we did our show on the Necronomicon. Since then, we have to realize the Necronomicon, as fictitious as it might be, actually has a reality to it, because if enough people, and I'm talking about teenagers now, or some of them grown up to be young adults, if enough people believe in these entities, then they begin to take on a reality that's larger than just the subconscious minds of those who believe them. And so we have, by this time, I think it's that there are as many people in this world who actually believe in the existence of Cthulhu as there are who believe in the existence of Asmodeus. I really think that's probably occurred, and in which case, Cthulhu has his own even dangerous reality. If you want to really look at it that way, I think so. So I think we can say now that. But then that leaves us with the interesting question: is what is what if the Necronomicon has achieved this kind of subjective reality? Which Necronomicon is the most authentic? Well, I'm going to weigh in on that one. I think that the most authentic, the most usable, the most occult, the one that is the most convincing from an occult point of view is Lynn Carter's version of the D translation. Not the first half of it. Those are cautionary tales where Abdul al-Hazred goes down into the Great Pyramid and just narrowly escapes being eaten. And then he goes down below the Tower of Babel, and he just narrowly escapes being eaten. And several incidents like this, which are referred to as cautionary tales, and they, you know, you can take those with a grain of salt. But the second half, Lynn Carter was an accomplished occultist. He was a magician. He knew astrology. He knew occult formula type magic. He knew it. And so therefore, the second half of Carter's D translation, which runs to 91 pages, by the way, it's extensive, that is actually workable. So those of you who really want to find a Necronomicon that's workable, that's the one to get. I don't want to criticize other Necronomicons too much, but I still, from an occult point of view, I think we're going to stick with Lynn Carter's. Now, Halloween is a great time to get spooky but in a sense, though, we shouldn't view Halloween as just a time to party. We should remember that this is Samhain, and this is that night. It's all over the world now. It's just, you know, down in Mexico, they have the Day of the Dead. And I remember on the Day of the Dead, back in 1988, I was on top of the Pyramid of the Sun. And over by the corner of the square area up there at the top of the pyramid, there was a circle of UNAM students who didn't want to be. They weren't showing off. They had their backs turned to us, and they really didn't want us snooping at them. And they were turning loose monarch butterflies from mason jars up there on the top of the Pyramid of the Sun on the Day of the Dead. So, as I say, all over the world, there is this night which the dead return, and of course the dead, your ancestors are the ones that are going to return to you. And so the idea of honoring your ancestors and before you go out trick-or-treating or have your Halloween party or whatever, is a very, very good idea. And, you know, I think you feel better about it. The Lord of Darkness this time, mode, and I could see going around the circle even with my mask veil that I had over my face. I could see the pain, and I could see the memories come welling up in the people who drunk the cup and then they made their declaration, and it was very moving. And then there were some that had nothing good to say about, there's a few who had nothing good to say about their family or anything like that. They just honored something in general, like fallen comrades or something like that. And you feel sorry for them. You say, gee, this is the time that we really need to honor those who have come before us in our own bloodline, in our own family. So this makes it a very meaningful and a worthwhile event. And then, of course, the most important aspect of it, the most important aspect of this is Moat's last declaration, where he says, as he finishes and pours the libation, and he pours out the last of the wine of remembrance, and looks at everybody around the circle and says, a libation to those remembered this night, and as you return to the realm of light, pray to be honored by those you knew when this cup is passed for you. That's a nice charge on the way to live, I think, and that is a fitting place to end our show on Halloween. Next week we're going to have a real treat and a very, very interesting situation. We are going to have a Masonic writer has written a magisterial treatise on the Royal Arch of Enoch, and this is by Robert W. Sullivan. And it's just been published. It's called The Royal Arch of Enoch, great big 600-page tome. And what he's attempting to prove here, and whether he succeeds or not, we'll find out. He's attempting to prove that the Royal Arch of Enoch, that's an advanced degree in both York Rite and in Scottish Rite, that this is derived from Ethiopian Enoch. That's what he's trying to get at here. And this is a rather controversial issue, because Ethiopian Enoch is pagan and demonic and it's the fallen angels who come down and instruct the sons and the daughters of men on all the various arts like sorcery and glamour and witchcraft how to make weapons and all these various things that are thought to be hellish. And each one of these angels, of course, has a name. And the leader of them is Samyaza, the head of the fallen angels. You may remember, those of you who have seen Beyond Emeria, you may remember Frater Solomon up there on top of Mount Shasta with his third eye and his horns, and up there telling us how he and his fallen angels influenced our culture. And this is what Brother Sullivan is trying to establish here. So we're going to have him on talking about his book, and this is a subject that has a lot to do with magic. So next week, tune in, and we'll dig down under Solomon's Temple and go all the way through the various chambers to reach the ninth vault, in which we'll find the cubic stone and the delta with the secret name of God. And if this sounds like Indiana Jones, you're right. It does in more ways than one. So until then, good magic, and we'll see you next week.